is beginning of a new reel, Barbara Reel 10. The new reel, Barbara Reel 10, turn one right. Turn one right, Barbara Reel 10. This is still Sunday afternoon. Suzanne, come out. Sunday afternoon, 14th December, 6-9. This is the beginning of a new reel, channel one right. Channel one right, the beginning of a new reel, Barbara 10, channel one right. Sunday afternoon, the 14th of December, 6-9, and Suzanne just come out, and we just doctored Mrs. Feet.
Along with looking at the horses, I got interested in watching Mr. Snyder approach Barbara with a job, and then her respond to it, and it was sort of a roundabout way.
Oh, that's interesting. She kind of saw some of that herself.
Out there, of course, I haven't been around his horses as much, and I don't know much about them and breeding lines and all. But I was watching Barbara, and as he would name a stallion or a mare, or say this colt was out of one horse or another, well, I'd see her face kind of change as she'd recognize the horses and realize, I guess, the breeding behind them. Of course, I didn't know anything about them, but they were pretty horses to me, but I can't judge because I've not been around them. But Barbara kept looking at them and looking at them, and I guess she could see they really looked nice, and he'd make the horses run and move, show their movement, how they moved. And he asked her if she knew this person or that person, and sometimes she did and sometimes she didn't. And gradually it started coming on to him that she knew something about horses rather than being just two girls out there wanting to look at his horses. And, of course, this is what would have been with me, just wanting to look at the ranch. But Barbara wanted to look at what kind of horses they had there. And she didn't quite know how to approach him when we drove out to the hay barn because she said she wasn't used to it. But I do okay as long as I'm with somebody. And so we told him that we just wanted to get a look at what kind of horses they raise here. And she was interested in hunting and jumpers. So then he showed us his yearlings first, the two-year-olds that were just about to. And at first I think he thought we were planning to buy a horse, or was looking at to buy a horse. So a preliminary conversation went on, and she started recognizing some of the breeds and all. And then we went down to look at the yearlings, the foals that were born in spring and coming on a year old. And that's when he started to approach her with a job. When he'd mentioned, do you know Joan, I can't remember names, but would mention people who had ridden for him, and she would know them. And this sort of recommended her in his eyes because she knew these people. And so he started talking about people riding around there, the girls who rode. And so they talked about a little bit about dressage, and they both discovered they were both interested in it. And this is, to me, it was sort of a discovery to Barbara, I think, more than to him, because later on she told me that she hadn't thought there'd be anybody like him down here that would be interested in the skill of dressage rather than winning the races. And he said, well, he worked around mostly, the approach he took was that how much he'd have to sell his horses for, that they could school him just so much, break him into the elementary commands and all, and then they'd have to sell him, because they didn't have anybody to carry on the training and show the horses in shows. Well, this is just right up Barbara's line, according to what she's told me, because she wants to train horses. So, I think he was, right then, he was working toward it. And he said that it was the big show stables, the ones who actually showed horses, that made the money, because after he had taken the trouble and done most of the work of breaking the horse, and then they would take the glory and the ribbons out of the ring, because all they had to do was just do a little bit more finishing off. So he would, not get as much money. And so Then Barbara said, well, that's the kind of thing I like to, you know, that I wanted to do, is to ride horses and train them in dressage. So we looked at the stallions and the horses he had in the stables, and then went out and looked at the Andalusian, and talked about how if you bred them with a thoroughbred mare, or you got the a lot of the Andalusian temperament with the thoroughbred smooth motion. And so then we went back, and he started talking more and more about his farms and how many horses he had and what kind of horses and all. And it was when we were at the stables before we went back to look at the Andalusian that he talked about the girls who rode for the racing stables or the thoroughbred farms making so much money, because all they do is gallop a certain number of horses in the morning and go on to another farm and another, and he said that a training stable or his type of person couldn't pay somebody that kind of money to train a horse. So the girls would go for the more money rather than the longer hours and less pay.
And his trainers would have to be better too, I guess.
Yeah, they would. Because he said all they do at thoroughbred farms is get on the horse and tuck the horse's head in toward the neck, I couldn't follow it too much, and just gallop the horse. Whereas his trainers would have to work with a horse, spend quite a bit of time, and to me, I think it would take a great deal more skill teaching a horse to do the things he does in dressage. So after that, and Barbara mentioned, got around to saying that she'd been to the English riding school, and he mentioned that one of his colts that he had sold was a Palomino, and Robert Hall, who evidently is a very well-known English horseman, and Barbara knew him, or knew of him pretty well, evidently from the tilts, said that she knew him, and of course this is probably pretty much a recommendation, because this Hall had said that the man's Palomino horse was one of the best he had seen in the whole show, one of the best trained. And after that, we went over to the other farm where he kept his brood mares, and we looked at all those. And when we got back, he got more direct about offering her a job, and she told him that she had a commitment. And of course, meanwhile, the background conversation with Barbara and I was saying, is that really permanent up there in Meredith? Because I could see what he's going at, and she could too after a while. And she said, I have to stay with it till June. And then so when we got back, right before we left, they came closer to an understanding where she told him that she had to stay till June, but after that, she'd be free, and this is the kind of thing she wanted to do, and that, of course, he'd want to see her ride. And he said, well, keep in touch, because from his conversation, he said he can sometimes get riders in winter, but he has a hard time in the summer. But he needed them in summer as much as in winter, because he said he don't start training them, working with them too much till, or this one he was planning on, a mare he's planning on showing, couldn't work with her until after January, and then you train through until the show starts. And he wanted somebody to train the horse and show him, and so it got, I wouldn't say a commitment or anything like that, but a pretty strong suggestion that he'd be happy to have her.
Yeah, that was right exciting to Barbara.
I'll say. She started, when I get seeing that something I've wanted is coming my way and I realize that maybe it's in my grasp, I get nervous and kind of shaky and fun. And it looked like that was what she was doing too. But anyway, she's pretty happy about it.
Nice.
Absolutely stunned me that he would show us his every single horse on that place and his stables and everything. And I think he started off just showing us the 2-year-olds, the 1-year-olds, and the ones in the stable. And then he started getting the idea that Barbara might be a good thing to have around. And so he took us back to see the Andalusian. And from there, it just kind of grew until we were seeing everything, his brood mares too, plus the tour of the farms all around there, his previous farm. And of course I was getting, you know, this money being talked about, you know, in his talking about buying the stallion for $25,000 and mares for $5,000 and all. And of course, this is hard for me to imagine people just spending that much money on a horse. And he showed the other farm he'd had, which was bigger, and it is just beautiful. I was thinking about that, and I would think that maybe he wouldn't mind if she kept the horse there, because you can keep them outside most of the time. But still, it's when you got a job, you don't have as much spare time as you think you do, because you use up so much of it.
Last time you got to go shopping today.
Or clean the house.
What's that?
I just said I hated doing the laundry.
What's wrong with that?
I have to go to a laundromat to do it, and it takes forever because I have to get all the clothes. And we do it once a week, so I get quite a bit. Jim is a maniac on using towels. It's got to be a new one every time. So I get there, and I have at least 3 loads, and usually I have to wait around. It takes a half hour to wash them, but then you have to get them in and get change and put them in and let them wash. Then you have to get them all out, put them in the dryer, and that takes another half hour. And it might sound, it's like a football game. You know, it takes an hour technically, but by the time I get through, it's usually about 2 hours. And I can't sit down and study at the laundromat. I just can't. So I sit there and look at magazines. And sometimes I'll go run some errands. But I can't. I gotta be back in half hour. And so I just don't like it. It's just tedious.
After all that, you didn't need to visit over at that other farm.
We were ready to come home. You know, I thought maybe she might want to look at some other ones, but I could tell she didn't, because, I mean, that was just too dumbfounding to even want to have anything after it.
Yeah.
So, but on the way, she remembered that she was supposed to go by and see this Mr. Heatherton. So we'd already passed the turn. We turned around and came back, and she went on up and told him that Faye wanted to see him and talk with him, y'all. And then this Mike Tilton came out. Of course, I hadn't heard of him or anything, and offered her to let him ride his horse. Well, I was kind of anxious to get back, but I thought, oh, well, you know. And so she seemed pretty excited about it. I didn't know why, but anyway, so he went in and got out the gear and everything for the horse. And she went out and got on it, and I sat down on this old overturned wash tub, these 10 feeding pails, I guess they are, maybe. And Mr. Heatherton was sitting down there, too, and Mike Tilton was standing there, and he asked me what my name was and where I lived and all, while they were watching her ride. And they were, the whole time she rode, you know, they commented that, you know, she looked pretty good. She was easy on the horse, not tense. She kept her knees a little bit tight, but that's because she rode an English saddle, and that she's, you know, pretty good rider, looked like a good rider. The only one I knew was supposed to be such a good trainer was this Mr. Heatherton, and I didn't know about Mike Tilton. She told me later that he was one of the best in the nation, I think.
Trainers.
Yeah. Of Western pleasure horses. And what struck me later was such a difference between Mr. Snyder and Mr. Tilton. Mr. Tilton seemed so much easygoing, and just right off asked my name and being friendly about it, not stiff or anything, and made me feel easy. And Mr. Snyder was, you know, very pleasant and all, and friendly and very nice to us, and yet it wasn't quite the same kind of just familiarity, I guess it is. But I immediately liked Mr. Tilton just right off the bat. He seemed such a nice person, you know, like he'd be fun to be around. And he was joking with this younger man there, too. But he left after a while, and Mr. Heatherton brought out an Appaloosa, a 2-year-old he was working with, and making it stand, just stand there with its head up and all, paying attention. And then he showed me, let it try to open and shut a gate, made it do that for a while. And he's talking to me while she was riding about having the horse having manners and all. First thing you ought to teach him. But he was real nice, too. And then she told me later, you know, how well known both men were, and just to meet them, you wouldn't know that they had such a high reputation because they didn't ever make it known. It's like it didn't matter to them.
Is there any connection between Mike Tilton's attitude and your
country music? I think there is. I see more and more of it now. I would have to bring it in with some other people I met in Alabama. We stayed there for a summer in Gunnersville, which is about 40 miles out of Huntsville, where they have a Nassau set up. And we were renting a summer cottage from people named Chuck and Agnes Ace. And after a while, my parents got to be real good friends with them. And we spent the whole summer in the evenings playing poker, playing poker and drinking beer, and going to parties and fishing. They were the type of people, very open and outgoing, and just come in and you're friends right off the bat. And for my mother and father, they respond to people like that very well. They're not very outgoing themselves, but if somebody makes the first advance and they're people like that, they call them beer drinkers, then they're friends right off the bat usually. And Agnes was the one who made the largest impression on me, because I was just going in the ninth grade, and she's the one who made me decide it wasn't so bad to be a girl after all, because she was very lively, you know, and always laughing loud. She had an Alabama accent, and she was country in a way, and yet in a way she wasn't. We used to go over to their house, and they'd sing for us. Chuck would get on the piano like a honky-tonk, and she'd sing, and they'd sing Frankie and Johnny and country songs. She was real loud, and they just put on a show for us. But it's just, it's right from the first, they wanted to be friends, and they were. And you accepted their friendship because they were so friendly. And it's the same way with Mike. And it's the informality it's kind of hard to say. The things they have on the country music shows between the performers they'll say, this performer's a good old Georgia boy. And this immediately recommends him to everybody else in Georgia and everybody else in the South just about who likes that type of music. And it's just an openness and friendliness. At school, you may sit next to somebody the whole quarter and never know their name or their last name. You might learn their first name. Or you might learn their last name from the roll call, but never the first. And I think to the country music type people, that would be unheard of because they're just not built that way. But of course, I don't know all of them. The ones that are outstanding are the ones who aren't afraid to be friends with people. Mr. Tilton just felt like calling him Mike right off the bat. You know,
but
like
Mr. Feddington wasn't like that.
No, sir. He didn't strike me that way. He was more reserved. And he was quite friendly and all, but he didn't have that way of putting me at my ease, and perhaps like Mr. Tilton does, it puts everybody at their easy with him.
Would you say Mr. Snyder just assumes the knowledge of horses, and you don't approach him, you just look at the horses? You said it all.
I think that's probably it. You're talking about horses, and you're not taking time to know each other's. You might want to know, like he wanted, was interested in what Barbara could do, what level of dressage she was at, or hunting. But right off the bat, he wouldn't be interested in her particularly as a person, or knowing what she was like. But
that still would be sort of, that'd be horsemanship.
Yeah, horsemanship, certainly, because that's what he wanted her for, to train his horses.
my children and Mr. Hetherington can sort of skip the horses?
I think so, because they asked Barbara, you know, how she rode, and he asked me, but he was talking to me, not anything about horses, just saying, you know, where are you from and what do you do? And I would have sat there like a bump in the log, not said anything, you know, because I didn't know him. But he didn't care. He'd say hello anyway.
You can apply that to country music, carry that on over to country music.
They don't care that they don't know you. Like Jack and Agnes, they and didn't know us from anybody. We just rent their cottage. But they came over. They made a special trip over and introduced themselves and say hello on their first name basis by the end of the evening.
Then with your down at the Cape, the music doesn't stand in between you?
No. The music is just, that's, he turns it on, he likes it, and he listens to it. And it doesn't have anything to do with it. With liking me or anything. I mean, I came over there for dinner one night when Jim and I were first going together. I felt like they acted like they'd known me a year. You know, just that I felt welcome right off the bat.
At
and
West,
they made no bones about it.
Country music.
Yeah. They're just friendly and open. But now with my parents, I asked Jim about later, my parents will call them by their first names, Bew and Nell, because they're parents-in-law, kind of. But they, I have always called them Mr. and Mrs. Lewis. And I kind of wondered about it. At first I thought maybe they didn't like them, but Jim said that people, that often they will call people by Mr. and Mrs. rather than by their first names. And I thought maybe it's just, you know, they don't feel that calling them first names is quite proper, so to speak, just like Jim calls all his aunts and uncles aunt and uncle. And I've never been told to call my relatives aunt and uncle. They're just Lib and Dick and John and Bonnie and whoever else. But I guess for them it's a form of politeness, yet still they're friendly with me right off. Now I think they were a little self-conscious with my parents. In fact, I know they were, from the way Bew acted. I thought that is interesting in a way why they do that.
Now, is this, this is all just second nature? Comes easy to them?
Most of them, I guess.
Just
yeah.
Somebody does it that way and they do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Or, in the music, the performers do it and the people enjoy it. And maybe if they wouldn't be able to do it themselves, because, I mean, not everybody's born so that they're outgoing and easy with people. But they enjoy seeing it in other people, and that's part of why they like the country music programs. I watched one a couple of Saturdays ago that, I think they call it, it was the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, Tennessee. In fact, the poem is called That Good Old Country Music. And most of the people in the audience, it was just packed, were in shirt sleeves and no ties or anything like that. It just very informal.
And that's Mike Hilton's manner, too.
Mm-hmm. Just informal, easy with people. But it's funny, when we left, he said goodbye, Barbara, and he called me Mrs. He said, goodbye, Mrs. I felt about 10 years older, you know, but it kind of struck me as funny because I've never heard that expression to call a woman Mrs. just as because she's married. See what a college education does to me. Meant that I told her about feeling funny about him calling me Mrs. You know, that it kind of tickled me. And she said, well, you see what your college does for you? You know, that you don't. I said, well, I never started seeing it until I got to college. So.
Yes,
way of talking.
How would you work that out?
Okay, Mr. Snyder. I don't think he would fit into country music at all, because he made the statement that raising horses is his bread and butter. It's not a pleasure for him, though I imagine he started because he likes horses, but it's a business. For Mike Tilton, training is a business, but it's also, he's drawn into the life of it too, of the type of, probably why he went for Western horses and Mr. Snyder went for dressage. It's a different attitude toward horses, which works in a different attitude toward life, I think.
Horses, your interest in horses is a kind of way of life.
Oh, I don't
be able to work. But I think that's Alvin's attitude.
But you have to work the horse.
I don't think you ever just go out and throw a saddle on a horse for pleasure of the horse.
Yeah.
Now, Cookie may be different there. They have horses around them.
Yes.
They've got, Alvin's got to have a horse right in the pasture next to him.
Yes.
And so has Cookie.
Yes.
Even if they don't go ride them.
It's a lot easier to see because there's nothing else but horses.
Mm-hmm.
All the whole family revolves around that stable.
He just lives horses.
Yeah, he doesn't live anything else. I mean, they don't even bother with having a house. All they've got is a trailer that they stuck out there by the stable.
Yeah.
Horses are better house than they are.
Yeah.
But you can have that and not have that same easy manner. That manner.
Mm-hmm.
You can be involved in horses and talk about the horses and not be interested in people.
Yeah, like Mr. Snyder.
Like Mr. Snyder, yeah.
I take Mr. Hetherington. He said that for a long time he trained horses. And he also trained riders. But he'd get on a horse to show them how to ride. But he said later on he discovered he could better train riders by telling them what to do. And to me, I got the impression that he was interested in the people he was training, as well as just telling the mechanics of how to ride a horse well. He wanted the people to, and in this sense, he was interested in the people themselves,
mm-hmm.
and training
mm-hmm.
that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what makes just this interest is what, to my mind, has always made a good teacher or whatever.
Yeah.
You sense that they're not just up there telling you how to do something, but they're interested in you learning it. And that puts a different attitude toward who you're teaching, and it just attitude toward people.
You think the Western riders are interested in tack like the Eastern ones?
When judging by that horse show, the younger ones are anyway. Because they, had the real fancy outfits with everything. But I think I couldn't say because I'm not familiar. Just offhand judging, I would say they're more interested in a good equipment rather than flashy equipment.
The Western.
Mhm. And of course, English doesn't use flashy equipment, do they? Too much. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to compare there.
You get to know it. You get to know and be able to see what's good. And anybody that rides English a lot can look over about five riders and five different saddles and say which one's the best saddle
mm-hmm.
out of the lot. Mm-hmm. And we'll make a, if they aren't careful, they'll make a judgment on the rider and the horse just by looking over the tack.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happens, what happens with the Western with the flashy saddles.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the flashier gear and that helps you judge.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens in English shows. You see the Siegfried saddle or the Hermes now is what you get. You look over a horse and see a Hermes saddle and a top grade leather bridle and stitched reins and you might mark that horse up a few marks just on the gear he's got on. if you're not careful. And this is not valid, but it's one way it happens.
You mean it happens in Easton?
Oh, yeah. A Hermes, you just look, you're supposed to be able to spot the professionals by finding the Hermes saddles, because they're the choice of the top professionals in the country. So it's high prestige to have a Hermes saddle. It used to be Siegfried saddles, German saddles. They're out now.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's like a fashion show.
It is a fashion show, just as much as Western fashions, you know.
Yeah.
But it's subtle. It's a lot more subtle. It doesn't show up in gold and tassels and stuff.
Would that be a distinction between Eastern and Western? The
in the riding, yeah.
Western,
I think
not subtle, and the Eastern, yeah.
I
mean, you know,
broadly. It's not, it doesn't hold up on a real close examination, but broadly it is.
The tack, just looking at the tack to see if it's taken care of, would that work with the Easton?
Yeah. Because a tack that's not taken care of shows. I mean, tack that's taken care of looks good. Looks better. And you know, you can start looking to in these showrooms. So at the shows, you can walk back along the in between the things and look into the tack rooms. And to look into a neat tack room with all the tack oiled. Now see, that oil makes a big difference. All that tack oiled and just the reins hanging like soft string practically. And you can just tell that at a glance. You don't have to go in and pick it up to see if it's like that. You can tell it.
You can
see it. And it looks good, you see.
That's the chief thing, just oil?
It's part of what we're keeping it clean every day. And polishing the metal on it and things like that.
Is it very much to oil it now?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a routine that just about everybody's supposed to learn the minute they start working with horses.
Well, how they approach it first is sort of routine.
Well, you've got to do it right.
No, not right, but first.
First.
You know, like they learn it first.
Well, it depends on where they learn it. They learn it, if they try to do it themselves and read up in a book on it, then they'll take the tack apart. You take the bridle apart completely.
Oh, really?
And many a poor learner is taking a bridle apart and not being able to put it back together.
Yeah, have pieces left over.
Just hang it off and quit. Like
I'm hard enough to figure out how the halter goes on.
And then, the big mistake is that they take it apart all right, and then maybe they'll get the order of doing things wrong. Like they soap it, and they think, well, saddle soap's all they need. And they won't wash it, they'll just put soap on it. And they'll get it sudsy. They think if they see suds, well, that's great. That's the way it's supposed to look.
Well, now, how would they get into that era?
Because it's soap. S-O-A-P.
And they'd get that through?
Well, just the word. After all, when you use soap, you expect it to foam.
You mean they'd leave the tack, they just think they do it with saddle soap?
Uh-huh.
So it's not experience watching anybody.
Well, no. This is if they've tried to learn it themselves. Now, if you're in a riding school or something, or if you're around horse people, they'll teach you how to do it. And then it's different.
How'd that be?
Well, for instance, I first started cleaning tack pretty much on my own. And the woman who taught me to clean tack didn't really know how to do it. For one thing, she didn't have the soap suds, but she used it to clean the tack. And that meant that, and we didn't have any sponges, so we used rags, and you can't keep them dry. You've got to wet them, and then they sud, so you can't keep them from sudsing. And she said it wasn't supposed to soap, but I could never figure out how I could keep it from soaping.
And you didn't see her do it?
She showed me, yeah. But she showed me how to do it, but she said she didn't do it right.
But it's still sudsed on her.
She couldn't. Well, we didn't have sponges. Now, a sponge won't suds like a cloth will, cotton cloth. We didn't have any sponges. And then when Mr. Daly came down, he was clean and tack, and he showed me, he said, he had sponges for one thing. And when we went in, he wanted to tell me about this ammonia. He says, now when you wash your tack off, I was listening, because I don't bother to wash it off, you see. When you wash your cloth off, when you wash the tack off, you just put a little ammonia in the water and you get the dirt off, and then you don't have to work at it. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So that started me washing the tack. You wash it off with just water, warm water, with a little ammonia in it. And then you put the oil on, if you're going to oil it. And this I got from Mr. Daly, too. Then you put the oil on, if you're going to oil it. Now, Mr. Daly just leaves it. He doesn't put any soap on afterwards, if he's oiling. But if you don't have time, if you're going to have to go ahead and do it, you oil it, you soap it after you oil it, because the soap will keep the oil out. If you put soap on first, it won't let the oil into the leather. And then he put the soap on it. And then he showed me the way they put up their bridles. It's a bit, it's figurated, but it's not quite the same as what I learned at Windmill Hill. The difference being that you to figurate it, you take the throat latch and bring it across the front. We put it on as a preservative.
Keep the soap in, keep the oil in.
Keep the oil in, keep it soft.
That the oil won't do?
Well, the oil will keep it soft, but it's only oil. It doesn't have any. See, soap has glycerin and some other things in it. It's extra stuff. And you put that in, and then it's just a preservative. It keeps the water out and things like that. And it makes it look good. See, oil leaves it looking dull. And the soap will make it look polished.
It really does. That's how you do it.
Oh.
But now, when I got to Windmill Hill...
You can just do this in a hurry, right out there in 10 minutes. After you...
You can.
And do.
I can, and done it in less time than that.
Over at Windmill Hill.
In Windmill Hill. But I don't take the stuff apart.
Well, but you did so much tack, and you didn't take all day.
I didn't take it apart.
Tell Suzanne just a little bit about. Tell Suzanne just a little bit about the leisure it takes when you take the tack apart and you make an occasion of it.
Yeah.
And the ritual of doing it right, like pouring tea.
For one thing, you've got to take the whole doggone thing apart, and that takes time right there. And spread it out and go and start off with the water, washing it, and then you have to put it aside and let it dry a little bit. You can't put the oil right on, because the oil won't go through the water either. And so you have to give it time to sit and dry a little bit. Then you put the oil on and be done really right. And you see, you don't have to do all this really right. Be done really right, you should put the oil in a pan and leave it on the stove so it's warm. And when then you put it on, we put it on with a cloth. Well, you shouldn't put it on with a cloth, you should put it on with a brush so it goes on real thick. And then you leave it, give it time to soak in. Now you've got to let the oil soak in. So, well, we had a whole bunch of tack to do, so all that could be done while we were doing the rest of the tack. But if you've only got one set of tack to do, it takes a long time. And if you got somebody else doing it with you, just sit around and talk horses mainly. At Daly's we had a wood stove, potbellied stove, and it gave out more heat than that little tack room could possibly use, so we'd have doors and windows open and the pot-bellied stove heating the whole doggone world. And we put on a thing of milk for hot chocolate. Sit around and eat and drink hot chocolate while we're waiting for the tack to get where we the way we needed it. And you take off all the stirrups and the bits and stuff, and you dump them in a pan of hot water. And then you take them out and scrub them with Brasso or something to polish them up. So you can be just sort of doing that while the oil's soaking in. And then, once the oil's soaked in good, you put on the soap, and instead of just putting it on with the sort of damp, you put it on, wet the soap instead of the water, instead of the sponge, and put it on like polish. And when you put it on that way, it goes on sort of thick, and it goes on, you can take a chamois cloth and rub over your leather, and it'll reflect your face. I've never done it, but I've seen saddles that have been done that way. Of course, also, once you've done it that way, to ride in a saddle like that is it's like riding on glass, but it looks nice.
Maybe you can do everything but see.
Yeah.
This is the great pride of the pack.
Yeah, it's got to look right. And you don't have to do that. And if you don't do that, it leaves it sort of sticky, and then it's nice to ride in. Because you don't feel that you're going to slide off of it. After you've got all the metal polished and all the stuff, the leather soaped, you've got to put it all back together again.
And that is a ritual.
That's where you've got to have a system, or you just lost. And you take, it's all right with the
said, now Faye, you watch me closely. It has to be done just this way.
Yeah. Well, it's the quickest way.
So she held up the bit first.
I held up the bit first. It's the bridle that's hard to put back together. There's nothing to a saddle. So you take the bit and you hold it up so that you know which way it's going to doggone things facing. And then you got it wrong, you know?
Is the bit first?
No. You take the first piece you pick up is the crown piece.
Right.
You get that so the broad straps on top, and the narrow straps on the bottom, and then you put your headband on it, brow band on it. The brow band's got to go on first. Then you buckle on the cheek pieces with the studs to the inside. If it's got studs, the studs go to the inside. If it's got buckles, the buckles go to the outside. Yeah. Then once the cheek pieces are on, you put on the bit. Then you can either put on the reins, or you can put in the slide in the cavesson. But that's easy. It just goes underneath. No matter how many other pieces you've got, if it's double bridle or whatever, the cavesson goes on the bottom. And that, you just slide that up through the brow band things. Then you put the reins on. It's the same with them. If it's got studs, the studs go to the inside. If it's buckles, the buckles go to the outside. And the buckle on the snaffle rein is on the right hand side. So you can get them switched. You can have it so the buckle's on the left hand side, but it should be on the right hand side, and the tongue on the left hand side. And so you get that, you get your reins on, and then you figure of eight it. You take the throat lash and cross it in front. When it loops around the back, you hook the end of the reins onto it so it holds the reins up, and bring it on around and buckle it in front to the opposite side thing. Then you take the nose band, and this is I got jumped about 5 times at Tilks for doing the figure put. Fixing the bridle wrong. You know what the difference was? At Daly's, I would take the nose band and buckle it inside the bridle like it was on a horse.
Mm-hmm.
At Tilks, they buckled it around the outside of the bridle. And Judy would come in and pick up one of my bridles and say, somebody still doesn't know how to fix a bridle. Because the nose band was buckled on the inside instead of the outside of the bridle.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take it someplace and hang it up.
Now that's a far ways from breezing an axle wheel. But I've seen that done. And it was done with leisure. And the motions, you see, were all right simple. All that held the right wagon wheel on was that good-sized bolt with big threads. Didn't take long to loosen it. And all you had to do, you didn't have to lift a thing. All you had to do was pull the top of that wheel out. So it had just a little angle in it. And it would hold itself. And you had a pound of axle grease. And just a little spatula sort of thing, like you hold your tongue with down with, and put two or three slices of that grease on there. And I guess people did that by themselves. I always did it with somebody else. I was there when somebody else did it. And it was occasion for considerable talk.
Mm-hmm.
And no haste.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a long ways from the tack room, you know.
Well, I...
Now that was a talk on Sunday afternoon. I chided Suzanne for getting off on Saturday before we had any reporting. That's Sunday morning. And I could just see her duck her head. And she came up. And we reported. She came in here by herself and reported. And then Faye and Barbara came back in and we reported together. And at the tail end, we got a little touch of that formality of cleaning the tack.
Yeah.
Faye and Barbara had done that, let me see, Saturday night?
Ritual.
Saturday night. Oh, they started late, but they also kept at it a long time. This is Channel 1, right? 6:20. Channel 1 right. 6:20. Now this is Barbara's last reporting. At breakfast on Tuesday morning, the 16th of December, 69, on practical questions, she tells us her experience in reschooling animals like Champ, and then parents who like for one child to get ahead of another. Sally, Champ had been mistreated somewhere along the line, and he's an old horse, older horse, mature horse. And he'd go crazy now and then. And we always thought, you know, he'd work out of it, but nobody here could work him out. Now, you've had experience with horses like that.
Yeah, I've had experience. I don't know, not knowing Champ, I don't know whether I've had anything experience with anything exactly like him or not. But, at Tilts, we used to get in a lot of horses for reschooling.
Yeah.
A lot of old ladies and gentlemen who had their horses, and they'd not be able to control them, so they'd bring them to us to be schooled.
Reschooling. Do you even have a word for it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. It's a word for it because you run into it all the time. It's half of the business, is at least. In some of these stables, it's all the business. Some stables specialize in just taking spoiled horses and getting them over it and selling them again. You can buy... Well, no, you can buy, you know, a horse that's spoiled like Champ. It's dangerous, and reschool him, and if you're successful, you can sell him, you know, for the price of a good made horse. That's a good profit.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all sorts of techniques, and patience being the big one. And I worked with, we had a horse up at camp, and we didn't reschool him, but he's an example of the sort of horse you meet. He was old, fairly old. He'd been a circus horse. And he was big, heavy. I think it's a Western breed, but they look like Appaloosas, except they're draft horses. They're heavy, and they've got the spots on their breed. And they look like draft horses. And this horse was looked like that type. And he, every time he decided he didn't want to go anyplace, would simply stand on his hind legs. Now, he didn't rear like a bad rear. He simply would do his circus trick. And he felt perfectly safe. You knew that horse was never going to get himself off balance. Because it was his trick. He'd been doing it all his life. And you knew that he was perfectly safe. But he would keep you up in the air for as long as he pleased. And you could not do a thing about it. He would just stay up there. And it was sort of, he was obviously doing it to keep from doing the work you wanted him to do, and yet you felt sort of mean about beating him up for it, because it was his trick. We finally sent him, we didn't have time to reschool him or anything, so we sent him back down the mountain, because we couldn't use a horse. Every time he wanted to stop, he'd stand up, you know. He was funny.
Now, what was that other case of the lady who...
Mrs. Finster.
Her touch was so heavy.
We had a couple of those, actually, but Mrs. Finster was worse because she had more horses. And she was...
She had beautiful horses.
Yeah, she had really beautiful animals. And lived over at Borsal Common and would take these horses out on the common to ride them. And she was too old to ride, and she was too not a good rider. And of course by the time she'd reached her age, she could never learn to relax. So the minute the horse did something, she was leaning forward and pulling on the reins, with her hands right back in her stomach, pulling on the reins. And those horses, the type of horses she bought, were not going to put up with that. And they would run away with her, and she'd have falls every week and send her husband into the hospital. He was a nervous man, and he'd seen her fall so often, I guess, that he just couldn't bear to watch her on a horse. And she would insist that he come. She wouldn't ride without him being there. And the poor man would sit up in the gallery and watch her, and he'd turn whiter and whiter and whiter the worse the horse got. And she brought one horse. She left for some time. She left two horses there to be school, but one horse she left longer, and that was Electra. Electra was a beautiful chestnut, beautiful big chestnut mare, hunter type. And when Electra first came, you could hardly get on her. She'd fidget, you know, step sideways, go forward, backward, any direction, just so you didn't try to get on her. And once you were on her, she would be on her toes, just up off her head, up off the bit, and prancing around sideways. And then you'd get her walking in a straight line, and the next second she'd be galloping. And she would just bomb off. And you'd bring her back down. And the girl that was riding her was a very, very good rider. She was the daughter of a good friend of the Tilts. And she'd had a lot of experience with dressage and cross-country work. And she was a good rider to watch. She had good form, and she could handle a horse. And she rode Electra most of the time, and she did well with her. And gradually the horse began to accept things, and she didn't shiver every time you got on her. And this girl liked her. She she liked her. She said, it's just a pity that this woman will never sell her either. Because she loves her horses, you know. She loves them, but she can't handle them. And finally the horse got to be where she was handled. You know, she handled her. Mrs. Finster came out and rode her, and she got a little bit nervous, but she didn't do anything. So she took her home. And within about a week, she was in the hospital. The horse had thrown her out on Bartle Common.
Tell you what was Champ's symptom?
The thing that Champ didn't like was on his left side. Any motion that came on his left side just sent him into a cold sweat. Made him nervous, and we found out that he'd been hit by two before on the left side of his head. And
but he was a gentleman.
Oh yes.
He never he never nibbled a horse.
Mm-mm. He was a gentleman. He didn't like to be caught except by one person. And he was very nervous when you mounted him. Mm-hmm. He would break out in a cold sweat, and no matter who mounted him, but once he settled down, he was all right. But you wave anything or anything happen on the side, on that left side.
Yeah, Now that sounds pretty serious, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's the sort of horse that... It takes a lot of time to and a good rider. I mean, a rider that doesn't mind getting hurt. To retrain a horse like that, because you're going to have to frighten him before he'll ever calm down. You just have to keep, for instance, mounting. You just have to get on and off and on and off, and he's going to be whirling all the time you're doing that. So you've got to be the rider. It's not a job for somebody who just wants to. It's a job for a professional who knows what risks he's taking. But eventually, you can get a horse like that calm. Now, we had a lot of horses that couldn't stand to be mounted up at camp. They'd been out west. They were green broken. And what that means is that they usually get on them in a chute. Rider gets on them from above, doesn't mount them from the ground. Then they open the chute and let the pony buck. And when the pony's through bucking, he's green broke. So they sell them as green broke. And, you can ride them around, but it's all right once you get on them. And they probably won't buck more than the first few steps they take.
Oh.
But we had about four of these the first summer. And two of them were really good bad. One of them was Fairy's Q, and she was going to be a beautiful horse. I saw her the next year when she'd filled out, and oh, she was pretty. Really nice little quarter horse. And she was the worst. You couldn't put your hand near her on the left side. You just put your foot, just bring your foot up, and she was whirling. Round and round in circles. Get your foot in the stirrup, and she was bucking and whirling. And we get two boys out there. And they slip a blindfold on her. And one of them get Jim. Jim was a great big 6 foot strong fella. And he could lift you up and over a 16 hand or 17 hand horse. He could just put you over on the other side of it. And I never felt so safe being put up on a horse as I did as Jim would do it. Because you knew he could put you right where you need to be on that horse. It was fabulous, even on Cassandra. Cassandra was a great big horse, and he used to put me up on
that. Where was that?
This was at camp, at Yanalassee. This girl's camp I was at.
How do you spell that?
Yanalassee.
Yanalassee. Uh-huh. That's good enough. Yanalassee.
He could lift you and not be and put you there without having to be, insecure because he couldn't hold you. And get Jim to boost you up on this little horse. And then you never bothered to take the stirrups, because the first thing you needed to do was stay on while she bucked. And the boys had to learn how to do this, because you had to let go of her immediately. The second the rider hit the saddle, you had to let her go and let her buck.
That's what you had to do with Champ, remember?
Mm-hmm. Because if you held on to her, now Jim, one of the boys, he's a real nice boy, and he was real good with horses, but he made the mistake of holding on to her one time. And she reared straight up and went over. And,
You break her neck.
Well, she could have. Yeah, she could have. She could have broken the rider's neck, too. The girl, fortunately, fell away from her. She was a good rider. She was used to doing this sort of thing. But for a moment, it looked like they were all three of them going to... Because the boy never did let go. And it looked like, for a moment, they were all three of them going to land in a pile. And, Every time you got on her for a while, it took this sort of thing, until you rode her enough to work her, to begin to work some of the excess energy out of her. And then we started working. I was working with another little horse that I had to be boosted on. She was not of Ferris Q's quality, either spirit or size, but she was frightened of being mounted, and she would do the same things. And finally, with my little horse, I finally got, one day I had her down in another ring, and I got my foot and was mounting her. We had Ferris Q down there too. And I got my foot in the stirrup and managed to have her calm enough so that she'd stand still. And I got halfway up, and she took off, and she was bucking. And I was draped across the side of the saddle. And she bucked about three or four times, and that got her a good, almost out of the ring. And then she stopped for just a second, brought her head up for just a second. In that second, I got my leg over. And that was it. Once I got my leg over, she was through bucking. And that was the breakthrough. After that, I got her so every once in a while she'd whirl with me. But I'd just keep getting on and off and on and off.
Either side?
Not either side. I just worked with the left side first. I would, later on, if I'd continued to work with her, I would work with the right side too. But the main idea was to get used to that leg swinging over.
This is the end of Channel 1 Right. This is the end of Channel 1 Right. This is the end of Channel 1 Right. This is the end of Channel 1 Right, and Barbara is reporting the end of Channel 1 Right, and I skip Channel 1 Over. This goes now to Channel 2 Over. I skip Channel 1 Over. I skip Channel 1 Over. Then this is the end of Channel 1 Right, the end of Channel 1 Right, the end of Channel 1 Right. This is the end of Channel 1 Right. This is the end of Channel 1 Right on Reel 10. This is the end of Channel 1 Right. And I skip Channel 1 Over.